Listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. And welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulig and Bricklayers and Allied Craftsmen, Local 15. Since 1972, Blake and Ulig has prided itself on providing comprehensive legal representation to labor organizations and their affiliated benefit funds on a local, regional, and national basis. And in unity, there is strength. Please support workers' rights. Bricklayers Local 15, Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. And we thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, history isn't made by kings and politicians, it's made by us. So say the people who wrote working class history, everyday acts of resistance and rebellion. Tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll hear untold stories of working class people who changed history. Then we'll find out who's making history in Milan, Missouri, where the Rural Community Workers Alliance is organizing and defending the immigrant workers who process pork for Smithfield. In the news, AFL-CIO greets Biden's appointment of Marty Walsh to be Labor Secretary, and Kamala Harris hints about Biden's immigration priorities, an expedited path to citizenship for Dreamers. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Ariana Blackman. She remembers an extraordinary fighter for the working class, Fred Hirsch. Now for the news.
Stand-Up KC is back in the new year with another strike targeting fast food and other low-wage employers. Work during the pandemic has been a nightmare, but the pending inauguration of Joe Biden, they aren't going to miss the opportunity to begin anew the campaign to raise the minimum wage to $15. So tomorrow, January 15th, fast food workers from Stand-Up KC and workers across the nation are going on strike. They and dozens, if not hundreds, of supporters will join a decorated car caravan launching a new movement towards $15 and a union. Mayor Quentin Lucas announced that he will join them in what will be a national day of action taking place in approximately 15 cities across the U.S. The workers say the elections in November and January showed that voters made it clear that it is time for change. Workers say increasing the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour and clearing their path to a union would improve the lives of millions of Americans at a time when so many continue to struggle as a result of COVID-19. During the pandemic, they say companies like McDonald's have recorded soaring revenues, but despite being considered essential, workers don't have paid sick days, healthcare benefits, work for poverty wages. They all work for poverty wages and struggle to get access to necessary personal protective equipment. The caravan will head to a McDonald's store where several workers are said to have had COVID-19. there will be a rally where workers and allies, including the mayor, will speak. People can come to the car decorating party at 10:30 tomorrow at St. Mark's Hope and Peace Church at 3800 Troost. The rally will be at McDonald's, 3051 Van Brunt Boulevard.
Richard Trumka, president of the AFL-CIO, issued a statement praising President-elect Joe Biden's appointment of Boston Mayor Marty Walsh as Secretary of Labor. Trumka said, "Marty Walsh will be an exceptional labor secretary for the same reason he was an outstanding mayor. He carried the tools. As a longtime union member, Walsh knows that collective bargaining is essential to building back better by combating inequality, beating COVID-19, and expanding opportunities for immigrants, women, and people of color. He will have the ear of the White House, the Cabinet, and Congress as we work to increase union density and create a stronger, fairer America." From the Boston Building and Construction Trades Council to the Massachusetts State House to the mayor's office to his own personal journey with overcoming addiction, Marty Walsh has always been a fighter who understands the power of working people standing together for a better life. Trumka continued, "President-elect Joe Biden has promised to be the strongest labor president in American history. His message of building back better hits home with our members because union growth and worker power are hallmarks of this agenda. It will take an unprecedented effort from the president-elect and the Labor Department to recover from the failed policies of the past 4 years, which have harmed working people and our families. But with Joe Biden and Marty Walsh, we are setting our sights high, starting with passage of the PRO Act, so the tens of millions of workers who want to form a union can do so freely and fairly."
At the same time the AFL-CIO reached the Capitol Hill insurrection on January 6th and is demanding Trump be removed from office, in a statement the Labor Federation said, "Following months of lies from President Trump that the election was stolen, right-wing rioters ransacked the U.S. Capitol building on Wednesday in a shameful act of our democracy. They succeeded only for a short time in delaying Congress from certifying what we know to be true in this democracy, and that is, Joe Biden will be the next president of the United States." Last Thursday, the AFL-CIO General Board met to plan the labor movement's response and released a joint statement demanding the president resign or be removed from office. "Trump is an affront to every union member and a clear and present danger to our nation and our republic. He should resign or be removed from office at once, whether through impeachment or the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution," the board said. "Hate and insurrection have no place in America."
Fernanda Echevarri writes in Mother Jones, in an interview with Univision on Tuesday night, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris teased a few details of the Biden administration's immigration plans, which, with Democrats now in control of Congress, will be proposed as our first order of business. Harris told anchor Elia Calderon that the plan will include creating a pathway for people to earn citizenship, though she didn't specify how. She said that part of their approach will be to shorten the amount of time it takes to obtain green cards and citizenship. President-elect Joe Biden said last week that he would introduce an immigration bill soon after taking office, but until Harris's interview, little was known about the plan. These vague details are the first steps in what immigrant rights groups are expecting from Biden, to not only reverse some of the damage of the previous administration, but also go a step further now that he has Congress on his side. Harris said she's confident Congress will give bipartisan approval to their immigration proposal, especially given the contributions of more than 200,000 essential workers who have deferred action for childhood arrivals, or DACA, and who have been putting their own lives at risk during this pandemic. Part of Biden's plan is to allow people with DACA and with temporary protected status to automatically get green cards. Combined, that would mean a path to citizenship for approximately 1 million people. That's the news from our side. The news tonight was read by Keith Washburn, and I'm Judy Ansel.
They never taught us any labor history. It's a mystery how we survived. We know all about the captains of industry, but it's the unions that help keep us alive. It's the unions that help keep us alive. Who needs Washington or the cherry tree? He could not tell a lie.
Good evening, and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight, we're going to be talking to John from Working Class History Podcast about the new amazing book that just came out, Working Class History, Everyday Acts of Resistance and Rebellion. I'm Christina Dismay, banner viewer for this show. Thank you so much for joining us, John.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
Well, first of all, I'm actually really excited this book came out. I've been following Working Class History on Facebook. It's been a few months back, earlier last year, and I've been following it and eventually the podcast. And when I saw a book came out, I knew I had to get you guys on the show. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the Working Class History podcast and what led to the publishing of this book?
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks so much for, you know, following us and supporting our work and stuff. But yeah, we started out in 2014. As a social media project, we kind of researched and wrote up a load of On This Day in History events in people's history, because we thought that anniversaries would be a good kind of viral way of getting that information out and helping people kind of engage with our history, labor history, people's history, social movement history, on a day-to-day level, and relate it to their everyday lives. And so we were doing that for a while, and it proved like a lot more popular than we anticipated, because now we've got like 900,000 followers across all platforms, which is, you know. And then more recently we started a podcast, so where we can like go more into depth, because obviously social media is all very short, very brief. We started a podcast where we talk to participants in social movements and learn about their experiences. And then we got approached in 2018, I think late 2018, by PM Press, who are an independent radical publisher. And they were interested in doing a book, which was a kind of a compilation of our On This Day in History posts. So we worked on that with them, and we put together a curated selection of events from historical events from our archives for each day of the year, and we put that together, and then Noam Chomsky very kindly wrote us a foreword for it.
And as I'm reading this book, because you find, personally myself, I'm a social studies teacher, I teach history, I teach geography, but there was so much in here that I did not know. But you guys, how you organize this book is interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you guys selected the stories that were put into this?
Yeah, sure. Well, for the past few years since we've been running the project, we spent a lot of time just trying to read so much stuff, about people's history all over the world. And when we find something interesting, we write it up, we add a date to it, and then it goes in our, we've got a database. And so this book, we went through, and our database has got about 4,000 stories in it. So this book is a selection of those stories. So we've picked two for each day of the year. So, it's the 14th of January today, so we've got about 10 stories about things that happened today, and then we selected two of them for the book. So in today in 1929, there was a strike in Port Adelaide, Australia, where so striking union dock workers attacked a steamship filled with strike-breaking workers, and a battle broke out on the docks. So that's one of them. And another one is on January the 14th, 1930, a communist called Albrecht Ali Holler in Germany shot Horst Wessel, who is a Berlin Nazi stormtrooper leader, and he shot and killed Horst Wessel. So those are the two things that we chose from for today. Essentially, the way that we narrowed it down is we wanted to get the most diverse selection of events possible. So, you know, diverse in terms of geography from different parts of the world, diverse in terms of gender, sexual orientation and gender identity of the participants, and different types of struggles from, you know, the Black Liberation Movement to anti-colonial movements to indigenous struggles to strikes and all those sorts of things. So the aim is to make it as, you know, ideally as diverse and international as our class is. You know, unfortunately, it's because of the kind of biased and kind of white male Eurocentric nature of the sources that we've got access to. It's not as representative and as we would like as yet, but, you know, that's something that we continue to prioritize working on with our further research moving forwards.
And you guys introduced, you actually acknowledged that in the introduction, it is acknowledged that there is a slight bias in the stories that are told here because you do have a lot of stories from the United States, from Great Britain, from Australia, Eurocentric, but it is introduced that in the very beginning of the book, and that's what I do appreciate, is being transparent with the stories that are moving forward, but still, nonetheless, there are stories from everywhere, events from all over the world that I do appreciate about this book. And one thing I want to learn about this book is here, well, a question I want to ask is, why do you think it's important, especially now in 2021, that people learn about this history, about labor and working class history?
Yeah, well, I think you know, it's almost a cliche to say, but now is more than, maybe not more than ever, but more than a lot of times, it's very clear to a lot of people that there's a lot of things wrong with the world, especially with the global pandemic, and how that is affecting everyone so unequally. You know, where a tiny minority of billionaires have seen their wealth explode, whereas for tens or hundreds of millions of working class and poor people are seeing, you know, environmental seeing economic, you know, devastation, and not to mention all of the deaths, but you know, the economic effects, and obviously on top of that, over the last since the early 1980s, we've seen rapid implementation of right-wing economic reforms across the world, which have drastically increased the disparity in wealth between those at the top and all the rest of us who have to work for a living or have to get by on, you know, what state benefits if they're available. In addition to environmental destruction, which continues apace. And so we think, I mean, it's always important for this stuff, but we think, especially in the difficult times we're in now, it's a really good time to take both inspiration from the past and learn lessons from it on how we can organize and how we can fight now and how we can start to win.
And that's actually perfectly leading to my next question, is what impact are you hoping that working class history, not just the book, but you can also extend to the podcast or what's available on different social media apps, but what impact are you hoping that working class history will make?
Yeah, well, essentially, as in that we hope that people will take inspiration from it from the different types of stories that we feature and the type of stories of resistance and human kind of bravery and dignity and struggle that we feature. We hope that people will be inspired by that. And also we hope that it will kind of spark people to look more and learn more about different types of social movements and go into in a bit more detail and learn from the people who took part in them, who talk in our podcast, for example, to think about how we can apply lessons from disputes in the past to disputes we're involved in today, and how can we learn from those past struggles? You know, for example, for people who are in, you know, labor unions, to look at what's happened in strikes in the past and what the ones that have lost and ones that have won, and how can we apply the lessons, the ones that have won, and particularly lessons like the importance of uniting across all groups of workers, you know, regardless of employment status, regardless of what union people are members of or not, and how important it is that workers ourselves, you know, control our struggles ourselves, that we don't leave things up to our representatives, either trade union leaders or politicians, to do things on our behalf, that we organize, that we have the ability to organize ourselves, because those are the kinds of struggles where people are more likely to win, where we control the struggles ourselves and they can't just be called off, say, by a trade union official or something like that, that we have the ability to organize ourselves. And as teachers in West Virginia did recently, when they took Wildcat strike action, that the teachers were able to organize themselves.
Actually, my next question is, are there any specific events in the book that are your personal favorite, either maybe not a single event, but you personally enjoyed when this book was being put together?
Yeah, I love so many of them. But when I was thinking about the answer to you for this question, one which kind of jumped out at me was an event on January the 5th, 1939. And it's about a Lithuanian Jewish anti-fascist who traveled to Spain during the Civil War of the Republic against the right-wing General Franco. And on this day, he'd been put in prison by Communist Party authorities, and he was transferred to the Mondrich prison in Barcelona, where he'd been held since the previous year. Now, Kaplan had previously, he'd been imprisoned for his activism. He was put in prison in the Soviet Union, and then he was also put in the Dachau concentration camp by the Nazis. And he escaped both of those. He escaped both times, and then he traveled to Spain to fight against the fascists. Then he ended up in jail again. And that was 1939 when he was in prison, and shortly after that, Franco's forces took the city, and it was thought that nothing more was heard from him, so it was assumed that he'd been killed. But after we posted about this on Facebook a few years ago, we ended up getting a message from a guy who turned out to be his son. And he told us he managed to fill in some gaps, that unfortunately Samuel Kaplan was able to escape from prison in Barcelona. And then he managed to flee to Morocco. There he got imprisoned in Tangiers and managed to escape again. And then he moved to Mexico and lived to the age of 89, had kids. You know, later he went back to Spain and connected with his old lover from during the war, that he reconnected, who was still alive as well, and found out that, you know, so it's just a really nice kind of human story. And not all of that fits in the book, because the book is just brief things, but in the book has detailed sources and links, you know, which includes all that additional information. But that was a really story. That's a real story that I love, not just because I think it's interesting, but also because of how we were able to find out that extra information through our project.
And that's great. I could see, I'm actually looking right now in the book, and for our listeners, if you end up getting this book, there's actually like a little symbol right next to some of the events that says that it's available on the podcast. So I guess there's two podcasts that go over the specific events. And does it also go into like kind of reaching out whenever the family member reached out to Working Class History as well?
Yeah.
Oh, that's neat. So, yeah, throughout the book, there's a little symbol on different ones. I guess you guys go more extensive detail in with the podcast, which you can, which not necessarily in the book or on Facebook. They're little snapshots of history, but the podcast can go more in depth.
Yeah, exactly.
And so my last question is, my last two questions, where can our listeners go to find more information about working class history? And are there any more plans that working class history is doing after this book?
Yeah, well, if people want to get the book, it's available in our online store with global shipping. It's at shop.workingclasshistory.com. To find out more about us and all our different projects, go to our website, workingclasshistory.com. Our podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google. Just search for Working Class History. It's also available on our website. And our On This Day in History posts are all over social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, you know, pick your favorite. And in terms of future plans, well, you know, we're always writing and researching more history. So we're working on that and working on more podcast episodes. And the book that we've done, we've had a great response so far. So we're definitely planning to do more print publications. So we're thinking about how to do that, like possibly having more themed history books, you know, about, say, anti-colonial history or anti-fascist history, things like that. And also our archive of historical events and struggles that we've written up, our plan is to turn that into a large website with browsable timelines and maps, so people can really kind of engage with things like people's history and labor history in their local area near them and places they're going to on vacation or wherever, obviously when at the point where we can take vacations and travel places in the future.
Right.
But yeah, those are all things we're working on.
Well, you know what? I absolutely look forward to the more projects that you guys start in the future. Thank you so much for joining with us, John. Thank you.
No, again, thanks for having us, and, you know, congrats on all your work. Keep it up.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers. Take it easy.
The Tempest is Kansas City's LGBTQ+ radio magazine. Every Saturday at 1 p.m., we feature a different host with interesting guests talking about a wide variety of topics that affect our community. Tune in Saturdays at 1 or stream us live at kkfi.org. The Tenth Voice, because we refuse to be silent.
KKFI, created and supported by you. Thank you for over 30 years of community.
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. Milan, Missouri is in Sullivan County in north-central Missouri, about 30 miles west of Kirksville. In 1993, an industrial pork plant opened there. It's now owned by Smithfield Foods. Rolf Christian is a local farmer. He joins us from his home in Green City, 10 miles from Milan. He's a founder of the Rural Community Workers Alliance, a worker center. Axel Fuentes is the executive director, and he joined us from Guatemala, where he's been visiting his family over the holidays. It's amazing what you can do with technology. I am also a member of the Rural Community Workers Alliance board. I interviewed them on Tuesday, and for more information about the Rural Community Workers Alliance, you can go to their webpage at ruralcommunityworkersalliance.org.
Welcome to both of you. I want to start with you, Rolf, because you've been around since the founding of the RCWA. Tell me about why it was that you got involved when a pork plant came to Milan, Missouri.
In 1993, this pork plant came into our small rural area here, and they started building, and then they started operating, and all of a sudden, this rural area was filled with immigrants that this company brought up here to work at the plant and also to live in our communities. And we're a very small community, you know, Green City has about 600 people living in it, and all of a sudden, they were immigrants. There were people here in town that I could not speak to because I did not speak their language. There were people in our community that were kind of shunned by the community. They were here, but they were not seen by anybody. And so obviously there were immediate needs because in the beginning, these immigrants that came here had nothing with them. I mean, each one of them brought maybe a suitcase at best. I found out pretty quickly, I was active in the church and social work in the community, that these immigrants were housed under terrible conditions. Some of them didn't have mattresses or anything to lay on, no furniture, it was just awful. And so I got involved with the churches and we started helping these people that came to our community. And we collected blankets and pots and pans and clothes and everything. And then eventually, you know, we found out that there's more than that. There's more than just pots and pans and coats, that there is an imminent crisis here. And that kind of forced us to go back to the roots of this thing and asking the questions, you know, who are these people? Where are they from? Why are they here? And what can be done about it? So it was then that we decided to organize, and I was on the board of a national organization. It was the Center for New Community in Chicago. We hired from Chicago an organizer to come down here and check in with these people that I could not understand, that I could not speak to.
You're an immigrant yourself, right?
Correct. I came here in the late 70s from Switzerland. So in 93, 94, we started organizing here in Milan. At the same time, we had organizers in other locations in the Midwest where there were packing plants because the issue became very imminent at that time. It was later then that we founded Rural Community Workers Alliance as a not-for-profit and then hired Axel as our executive director and organizer in Milan.
That brings me to you, Axel. Why did you come to Milan?
This job bring me to Milan. One of the first things that I did in Milan, it was to conduct a listening process among the workers from the plant and also other workers from other small factories there. So that's how I got to Milan.
Okay, and you had been an organizer. Where was it?
I did some organizer in Guatemala, and then I did the organizing also in Milan, where I've been for over 12 years organizing the workers are there.
So tell me about the workers. Who are they, and how has the workforce changed over the years that you've been there?
When I got there years ago, Judy, the majority of the workers were actually workers from Latin America, from Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Cuba, and a couple of Nicaraguans. And over the years, yes, the demographic has been changing. About 5 years ago, we started to see the incoming of immigrants from Africa, especially from Congo, but we do have people from Senegal, Tanzania, Eritrea, Guinea, but the majority are from the Congo. And most of the immigrants in that area actually are working in the pork processing plant. Other workers started to work in a sewing shop and another dog food factory, which are smaller companies, but most of the immigrant workers are in the pork processing plant.
And that pork processing plant now is Smithfield, which took over the plant a number of years ago. Tell me what kinds of issues RCWA is working on with those workers.
Okay, well, I have to go back on the history when I started to conduct my listening process in Milan, Judy. And I can tell you that over the years that I've been organizing and listening to the workers, some things have changed and some things never changed. And I can start to tell you that one of the first things that I hear years ago when I got up there, it was that actually shocked me was that workers in the plant were not even able to bring their own lunch in the plant. So they pretty much were forced to buy lunch in the company. And I hear stories from workers that were not able to take bathroom breaks. A lot of the workers getting injured because the speed of the line or the number of pieces of meat that they have to elaborate per minute. I hear a lot of women having urinary tract infections because they were not being allowed to take bathroom breaks. Same as people using diapers because the same issue, especially women, I hear in their period time, a lot of them came in many occasions even crying to my office because they were pretty much humiliated when they were asking for permission to go to the bathroom. I hear a lot of mistreatment by the supervisors. I specifically remember stories from workers saying that they were feeling like they were being treated as animals instead of humans because the supervisors were angry and in many cases violent. I hear stories from many women also that they said that they were sexually harassed, but they didn't complain because the fear of getting terminated, and in many cases also the fear of even getting deported. When I was trying to make these workers to make an official complaint to the human rights divisions or even to the anonymous lines from the company, they said, oh, no, I don't want to do that because I don't have a witness. It's really hard for me to prove it, but I just want to tell you that this is happening in this company. Over the years also, the speed of line is one of the biggest affecting or biggest pressing issues in the company because workers are not even able to sharp properly the knives, or even they don't have enough time to put the knife in its case when they need it, and then they are in a higher risk of suffering injuries or also the repetitive motion injuries.
Of course, this plant has no union. The RCWA is like the major defender, right, of these workers. Is that correct?
That's correct, Judy. In the sense, we advocate and we empower the workers to stand up for their rights on their own. But obviously, we do support. I have to tell you that in our organization, there is a council which is formed for workers only, and they are the ones that they can tell how to help them in order to address the issues.
And let me ask you, Rolf, is there much support for the workers from the community? Do members of the community care about these, what he's just described as horrific working conditions?
Well, I think that most of us in the community are just a bit scarcely aware of these conditions. There is not much communication here in the community between the immigrants and the people that live here. I have heard from some Anglos also complaints about the work conditions at the plant, but we have to understand practically this is the only employer in the next 100 miles. This plant stands here, seems to be very important to the survival of the community and of the county. So people are not very willing to be outspoken about the issues there. It is the 1,200 jobs that this company creates that are the largest bonus that we're getting from them.
Are the management Anglos, you know, American citizens, born and raised, or what? Who are the managers?
Most of the managers are Anglos. They do have one middle level manager out there that is so Latino, but most of the managers are Anglos.
We're talking to Axel Fuentes and Rolf Christian from the Rural Community Workers Alliance in Milan, Missouri. So you've described a situation in which the workers are pretty isolated from the community, it sounds, the outside community, and the working conditions themselves are pretty terrible. So describe what happened when COVID hit the plant, because You know, one would have thought that you would have gotten some help from the government to protect people, but what happened?
I remember when they closed the schools in my land, a lot of the people were actually really scared. And they came to me and they said, well, the plant is not doing anything. The plant is just running normally. There is not a pandemic. Nothing is happening. The company was not even providing hand sanitizer by those days. So a lot of the workers approached me and they said, what can we do? How can you help? We feel like we are really concerned and really worried that we are going to be dying in this plant and the plant is not doing anything to protect us. My advice was, okay, let's get together, let's talk, and see what you guys are willing to do. So we brainstormed, and some of the workers said, okay, we should start probably writing letters in order to take a process where we can let the company know that we are concerned, that we are afraid of getting infected, and requesting the company to take some measures to protect us. So that's how we started. We started approaching management through a letter. 2 weeks later, after the letter was delivered, the only thing that the company did was to provide hand sanitizer. That was pretty much all. So the workers felt like they were ignored by the company, even when they were requesting PPE or to take other measures of protection, and the company didn't do anything. So then the workers said, well, we probably should get to the media and see if the company reacts. And that's how it published the first article in the Columbian Missouri. And then the company started just to provide a mask, just a face cover per day. One mask, one of those surgical masks. We get this wet. So these masks are getting wet and in the kill floor getting dirty, and they are not replacing those masks. So all the workers say, well, what else can we do? Because the company is not escaping the workers. The company is not placing the workers in the cafeteria or locker rooms in any other places. So that's when we got in contact with another group of lawyers from Public Justice, and the consensus from the workers was to proceed to file a lawsuit against the company. The lawsuit was filed when the company actually implemented some measures because the court ordered to the plant to implement the CDC guidelines. So it became the first plant in the United States to be forced to comply with the CDC guidelines. But it was after the lawsuit. Even when the lawsuit later on was dismissed because the court said that was OSHA, the one that's supposed to be overseeing the occupational working conditions, and our case got dismissed, but that brought together the workers, and that forced the company to stay the workers at least in the cafeteria and hallways and locker rooms, that they were working without any protection and without knowing if any of the workers was actually infected. Because the first case that I know that from a worker from the plant, that it was he got tested, not in Sullivan County, but in another county in Iowa. He got tested in March, and he got positive. And by that time, the company didn't even notify other workers about this case.
Have there been a lot of cases in the plant of COVID?
Yes. Honestly, I can say that when the pandemic started, a lot of the workers were getting sick, but they were not being tested. So the testing, if I am not wrong, started almost in June. But before, a lot of the workers were already sick. And then the company started to hire another company to test for COVID. And a lot of the workers, yes, they have been tested positive. And unfortunately, we also have people, workers that passed away due to COVID-19.
Do you know how many?
I'm not sure about the number now. I'm going to lie to you if I give you exactly a number at this time. But for sure, two of my friends passed away for COVID.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Personal friends.
Okay, so we're almost out of time, but I want to ask both of you, what are your proudest moments in the history of the RCWA?
For me, I think the biggest stories were the conversations I was able to have with the immigrants, with people that came to this community that I did not know before, and what they shared with me, their stories, their history, their lives. It was the moments that we held hands together, and when we just listened to each other and just talked to each other and just connected as a community. And that, to me, is the important part. From the work standpoint, as Axel said, we have not accomplished that much. The line speed is going faster today, and I am sure you're aware that the Trump administration just took the restrictions off the companies for line speed, so the line speeds will even be going faster, and the employees and the workers are going to be struggling even more. However, the ability to connect, the ability to have conversations, and the ability to just jointly move forward on these issues, I think that is what we have to strive for. I think this is where we have to keep on moving forward. If we can build this community between immigrants and us and our moral values and our ethical values, I think eventually these companies will change their ways, and eventually we will all, as a society, as we are struggling at this very moment in this world, we will all find these better ways. But in order to do that, we have to communicate with one another.
Well, there are many moments that I feel proud of, Judy. But one of the most important things that I feel proud of is that the workers are being empowered to stand up by themselves. And I can tell you concretely, there are moments since the beginning up to today, I feel proud that we were able to change the way how the company was handling the lunches when they finally allowed the workers to bring their own food. I feel proud that in many occasions, workers from different lines, from different work lines, were able to come together and stand against the supervisors that were mistreating them. I feel proud of moments in the when workers also from the cleaning crew stand together even to request the basic things that the company was not providing. I feel proud in moments when the communities such as Kirksville and Milan also advocate for them and came together, such as May Day, for example, just standing against the racism and standing for the immigrants and refugees in the area. So those are moments that actually make me feel proud. I feel proud that during the COVID era, we were able to bring workers together to stand also on filing this lawsuit, and workers that have been able to also talk to the media. So those are moments that actually makes me feel proud of being part of this organization.
We've been talking to Axel Fuentes, director of the Rural Community Workers Alliance in Milan, Missouri, and Rolf Christian, a board member of the same organization. Thank you both very much.
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, journeyman wireman of IBEW Local 124. Tonight, I am going to speak to you about the life of activist Fred Hirsch, who just recently passed away on December 15, 2020. Fred Hirsch was born in 1933 and was a member of UA Local Union 393 in San Jose, California for over 50 years as a pipe fitter and plumber. His local's website says of him, "Fred reminds us that the fight for working people doesn't end with good jobs, wages, and working conditions. We must also have peace, equality for all, civil rights, and human rights. He is the conscience of the local labor movement, inspiring us to stand up for what we believe in, especially when it is hard. Fred Hirsch joined the UA back in 1953 and started his apprenticeship in New York, certain in the knowledge he wanted to be a part of the working class. He quickly became an outspoken, and in some circles unpopular, voice in his local, encouraging workers to protest the Korean War and for his local to admit more African American members. Fred says one union official told him, "If you pass the test, kid, we want you out of here." Fred Hirsch had the misfortune of coming of age during the McCarthy era, and rumors of his communist sympathies made it hard for him to work in Los Angeles when he and his family moved there as well. His family soon moved again to San Jose and joined Local 393. According to Fred, L.A. local union officials warned the officials in San Jose that Fred was a communist, and they paid him a visit on the job to ask him if it was true. He recalls it like this: "I told them this accusation was because I'm an active anti-racist and politically active. If I say I'm a communist, I won't be able to work. If I say I'm not a communist, you'll say I'm a liar. There's no way I can answer that question, except to say that we have to work for racial equality and work to have our unions, this union, function in the political world for working people, and that we have to work for peace in the world. If that makes me a communist, then so be it." Apparently, this response satisfied the officials, and the matter was dropped, though rumors persisted, he said, for a decade. Despite this early controversy, Fred was quick to be looked upon by his fellow local members as a leader and served in various local union positions, including as delegate to the South Bay Labor Council. In 1958, Fred founded Local 393's political committee in order to successfully fight back Proposition 18, which would have made California a so-called right-to-work state. As the civil rights movement picked up steam, Fred and his wife Virginia became members of the Santa Clara Friends of the Student Nonviolent Organizing Committee, and he helped bring speakers such as Stokely Carmichael to South Bay. He would also ask the local to financially support the civil rights movement with donations. One time, when he stood up at a meeting to make such a motion, he was literally knocked out and dragged out of the union hall by some right-leaning members. But he opened some minds and got a ton of respect when he immediately marched back in and continued. When farmworker organizing began with Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez, Fred lent his voice and support to their struggle for justice as well, even moving his family to Delano to be more involved in their struggle. At first, UFW organizers were a little nervous of Fred, but he soon found a place working with older Filipino farmworkers who were tracking scab grape shipments out of the area and working to stop them. Fred's biggest passion was bringing together the various fights for justice across his own community and far beyond it. Fred traveled across South America documenting the incredible oppression of trade unionists there. He came home and told other local members that one may be killed down there just for being a member of a union, and that he had been concerned for his own safety the entirety of his visit. He also brought back a trade unionist from Colombia to speak of what was happening there. This really touched a nerve for many people and opened their hearts to solidarity for their fellows across borders. Fred pushed his local labor movement to support peace, organizing rallies of local members to protest the Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq wars as well. He successfully campaigned for the South Bay Labor Council and then millions of members of the California Labor Federation to join U.S. Labor Against the War, which is an organization devoted to the demilitarization of U.S. foreign policy. Fred also brought organized labor in his area into advocating for comprehensive immigration reform and protecting the environment. Fred was instrumental in reclaiming and repopularizing May Day in the area after decades of government repression of U.S. May Day events. For years, he and Adriana Garcia of MAIS, a militant organization of Latina women, co-chaired the May Day March in San Jose from the Eastside Barrio to the City Hall. Of his life of activism, Fred noted, "I would not be true to myself or to the movement of working people throughout the nation if I didn't do what I could." Thank you, and have a great evening, everyone.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. This is the first time we've had a full calendar in months. HCA Hospitals Research in Menorah announced that they will be setting a minimum wage of $15 for all employees except union employees. The union has been fighting for years for a $15 minimum. The hospital is offering $12.50 in current negotiations. There's a rally tomorrow at 6 a.m. to protest HCA's union busting in front of Research Medical Center, 2316 Meyer Boulevard, Kansas City, at 6 a.m. And then, when you get done with that, you can head over to the Car Caravan in support of $15 and a Union for Fast Food Workers. This is a national action. And they will start decorating cars for the Car Caravan at 10:30 a.m. at St. Mark's Hope and Peace Church, 3800 Troost. They'll have the supplies. Just bring your car, and you can get in the caravan. This will last to 1 p.m. On Saturday at 9 a.m., there's the Wyandotte County Democratic Breakfast. It's on Zoom, and the speakers are Unified Government Mayor David Alvey and Commissioner and State Rep Tom Burrows. To get a Zoom link, you can find our calendar on the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. All Souls Unitarian Forum will have Reverend Rodney Williams talking about the Poor People's Campaign. That's on Sunday at 10 a.m. Again, the Zoom link is on our calendar at the Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. Kansas City Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee is meeting Tuesday, January 19th, 6:30 p.m., also on Zoom. Call Jameson for a Zoom link, 816-809-9441. And Missouri Jobs with Justice is having a preview webinar of the upcoming Missouri Legislative Session, Legislative Session Preview Webinar, at 2 p.m. on January 20th. And you can find the link for that at mojwj.org/webinar. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is called No, the Trumpers Aren't Populists. Thomas Frank on his new book, The People Know, A Brief History of Anti-Communism. He'll be on for the whole show. The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Keith Washburn. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special, which is Shots in the Night Comedy Theater.
There is no disgrace in standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.